Fourth case, Wilson versus Goetz. Ms. Friesen? Oh, Mr. Friesen, I'm sorry. Yes, go ahead.
May it please the court. My name is Kyle Friesen. I'm representing the appellant, Daniel Wilson. The case before this court is not a case about trial tactics or second-guessing how a lawyer prepares for trial. Wilson's trial counsel presented as the only evidence that his client was insane at his criminal trial an expert who had never evaluated that client for insanity. He made no effort to secure an evaluation for insanity. On top of that, he made no effort to consult with his expert, and he never conducted any further investigation of potential witnesses. Now, the failure to present a credible witness on the issue of insanity is by itself sufficient prejudice under Strickland. So now, the Strickland prejudice standard requires that, but for counsel's error, there be a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different. In this case, the state emphasized specifically this flaw in the expert's opinion, the lack of a sanity evaluation, and put forth to the jury the choice between two experts, one who had evaluated Wilson for sanity, and one who had not. Now, had Wilson's counsel, Mr. Schnack, requested an opinion based on a sanity evaluation, the choice to the jury would have been between two experts, both credible, who had done a sanity evaluation. And even if that's just a toss-up between the two experts, there's a reasonable probability, a better than negligible probability, as the Supreme Court referred to it, or rather as this Court referred to it in describing the Strickland standard, then that balanced choice would have been considerably better than the choice the jury was given between a wholly incredible witness and a credible one. Of course, Strickland also requires analysis.
Did the judge comment that his testimony was able and convincing and persuasive?
I don't believe the judge said it was persuasive. The judge did say that it was cogent and coherent, and that the doctor appeared to be qualified. That doesn't mean that the doctor did what was appropriate, or that doesn't mean that the doctor's opinion testimony was credible to the jury or persuasive on the issue of insanity.
On the other hand, though, if a doctor says you're, as this doctor did, that you're unable to stand trial, but then later that you are able to stand trial, that enhances the credibility of that witness. And then when he testified, but at the time you were not able to conform your conduct to the requirements of the law, it seems to me that that's a basis for crediting that that witness.
That certainly may be one basis for crediting a well-founded opinion, but the fact of the matter is that a sanity evaluation and a fitness evaluation are targeted towards different issues.
That's correct, but it is also a doctor who as happened here. He examined him and found that he was not competent to stand trial.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Later, he changed and said, yep, now he is okay. He can stand trial.
Actually, Your Honor, the second fitness evaluation where Wilson was determined to be fit to stand trial was performed by a different psychiatrist.
And he agreed with it, though.
He was not asked to come to a conclusion on that issue.
His opinion that he offered at the trial was that he was incompetent, that he was insane at the time that the crime was committed. In that two-minute interval when he shot this fellow, his boss, sitting in the car. That was his testimony at the trial, that he was insane at that moment.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't know what more you could have hoped for here as a defense in a case like this. Seems to me if you bring in all these lay witnesses to talk about how bizarre he was acting sometime before, that just juxtaposed how rational he seemed to be acting on the moment that he pulled the trigger.
Well, Your Honor, the rationality of his action fits together with the with his delusional beliefs, which provided that rationale. The conduct that occurred before, to which the lay witnesses would have testified, is consistent with those delusional beliefs and supports the notion that the rationality of the defendant, Mr. Wilson, at the time of the shooting was based on those delusional beliefs. To the contrary, the state presented evidence that and relied on it in argument that he had considered committing suicide but stopped because he was worried about what it would do to his children, and that event took place months before the shooting. He also presented evidence of an occurrence with a brief interaction with a neighbor that took place days before the shooting. And all of this was intended to support the notion... there was also a discussion of whether or not the shooting was the result of some sort of a plan that might have been forming over the course of the previous months. All of this went to show that Wilson was coherent and based his conduct on reality rather than his delusions. The lay witnesses would have introduced contradictory evidence that during this time prior to the shooting that he was rational and free from delusional beliefs regarding the victim in the case.
Can you explain what the in Illinois law what this guilty but mentally ill facet of the verdict is?
Guilty but mentally ill is a verdict that essentially states the defendant is not legally insane but is mentally ill. And the legal insanity standard requires both a mental illness and the result from the mental illness that he was that he lacked the substantial capacity to appreciate the criminality of his conduct at the time.
So how does that affect his subsequent proceedings, sentencing or place of confinement or things like that?
Your Honor, the law requires that Wilson be observed and given treatment as the state deems appropriate because of his verdict. That's the only effect that it has. There have been observations that, as a practical matter, the capital punishment is not frequently meted out on those who are guilty but mentally ill, but Wilson was never, the state never attempted to seek capital punishment in Wilson's case.
So in a case like this tried in Illinois, the jury has a number of verdicts. Is it guilty of murder in the first degree, guilty of murder but mentally ill?
Yes, Your Honor. And not guilty by reason of insanity or not guilty.
It would seem with that second not guilty but mentally ill that you're not going to find many verdicts that are going to come back with an exoneration based on mental illness, I would think.
That may well be the case. But if a jury is following the law and considering evidence that he was unable to appreciate the criminality of his conduct at the time, then one would assume that at least sometimes there would be such a case. And this would be a likely candidate for such a case because not only was Wilson mentally ill, he was severely mentally ill. He was suffering from psychotic episodes, ongoing course of delusions going back at least until 2001, quite possibly as far back as 1987. And given the facts of this case, for the lawyer, Schnack, to fail to present credible evidence from an opinion, from an expert opinion, in the form of an expert opinion based on sanity evaluation, evidence is an extreme lack of judgment. Counsel went forth affirmatively to seek the opinion of Dr. Parwadikar, who performed a fitness evaluation, and specifically requested an opinion as to insanity without any further evaluation. This is contrary to numerous legal authorities that he would have every reason to believe, that state that he would have every reason to believe that a fitness evaluation supporting a sanity opinion would not be sufficient to give his client a fair trial. was such a, I mean, Ake is one such case, Nichols is another, and those stand for the proposition that fitness and insanity are simply different issues. Now, the states put forward an argument that he could rely on the doctor's experience in this matter. That may or may not be reasonable for an attorney to defer to the expert of a non-legal mind. However, Dr. Parwadikar's opinion on the subject was that his opinion based on a fitness evaluation was not going to be enough to effectively present Wilson's defense. Now, this evidence is sufficient to demonstrate both prejudice and deficient performance under Strickland, and the state court's decision, which was primarily directed at the deficient performance prong, was completely unreasonable because it held that Wilson's counsel could rely on the psychiatrist's judgment and yet rely only on a part of it. And because the evidence is undisputed and it establishes habeas relief, this court can and should grant habeas relief to Wilson based on his petition. In the alternative, this evidence is at least sufficient to warrant an evidentiary hearing, which he was denied at the state court.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Friesen. Ms. Sanders?
Good morning, Assistant Attorney General Catherine Saunders for the respondent, Warren. I'd like to begin initially by addressing Judge Evans's question about the GBMI standard. It is, in fact, guilty but mentally ill verdict. I believe 16 states, there's a U.S. Supreme Court case, Clark versus Arizona, explained that the GBMI verdicts came in. Legislatures were concerned that juries were falsely acquitting on insanity grounds after Hinckley shot at Reagan. And so essentially it's sort of a third way to make sure that the defendant is receiving treatment to accommodate the juror's concerns about the petitioner's mental illness, but also when they make sure that they hold to the legal standard for insanity.
What did the state argue in this case?
Pardon me?
What did the state argue? Did the state agree that he was mentally ill and the jury should return a verdict of guilty but mentally ill?
What did the state argue? Mm-hmm. They said he was saying that he could conform his, or that he had an appreciation of the criminality of his conduct. Dr. Henry testified that rather than looking at the sanity question the way Dr. Parwadikar did, as sort of a slice in time, he was saying he was insane at the moment he pulled the trigger, and then he returned to sanity when he called 911 and said, oh, I killed my boss, I did it purposefully. Dr. Henry said, no, really, what you have to do when you talk about and make that sanity determination, you have to look at a broader slice. I believe he said it's the whole film, it's not the freeze frame. So he would look at the morning, the conduct throughout the day. And he said that the planning activity, for instance, when the petitioner said he'd been thinking about killing his boss for some time, and the fact that he went, when the boss came to pick him up to go to the airport, and the fact that he placed a loaded gun in his pocket.
What does that have to do with sanity?
Pardon me?
What does that have to do with sanity?
What does it have to do with sanity?
Yes.
It's planning activity.
Say people don't plan?
Dr. Henry believed that it was important that.
You don't think Oswald planned to kill President Kennedy?
I think he did, yes.
But don't you think he was a nut?
My personal opinion on that matter.
The notion that insane people don't plan. Where does that come from? There's no basis for that.
This is simply, I'm just telling you, Your Honor, Dr.
Look,
Henry's opinion.
What I find disturbing about this case is that I don't know who the prosecutor was, but the prosecutor was excellent. And he demolished Packwalder. Right? He demolished him because of his failure to conduct a sanity examination.
Your Honor, I want to clarify that point here. He did evaluate. Dr. Parwadikar did absolutely evaluate the petitioner for sanity.
I'm telling you what the prosecutor did to Pat Wallander in his cross-examination, and then how he used that in his closing. He made Pat Wallander sound like a fool.
Well,
and if you just go through this, you know, he starts off, out of the 14 pages of your fitness report, there are a grand total of perhaps three paragraphs devoted to the issue of what the defendant did on November 20th. In your fitness report, there's no comment regarding his sanity as of November 20th. No opinion concerning it, nothing in your report. And then he goes on and says, you know, why didn't you do that? Why didn't you talk to his family? Why didn't you do any of this stuff? And he keeps harping on it. And he asks, and he elicits from him the fact that he had asked the lawyer that he about it, re-interviewing him. I do not understand why his lawyer didn't ask him to re-interview Wilson.
Well, Your Honor, Dr. Perwatiker is at...
The prosecutor says, "Don't to Peckwalder, don't you think it would have been helpful for you to revisit the issue with those people who dealt with him firsthand and talked with him firsthand to gather whatever information you could to increase or enhance your basis of knowledge about the guy's behavior?" And on and on and on. What is there to lose? What have you got to lose by picking up the phone or driving up to Quincy and talking to these people? Or even doing it from St. Louis?
And Your Honor, he says, it's not my practice. It's not the Strickland standard.
Pardon?
Strickland doesn't ask, was there anything to lose? What would he have to lose? Counsel is simply held to the Strickland standard.
This is the whole case. This is all he has, right? He shot the guy. No question about it. This is all he has. Is his insanity defense.
Your Honor.
And he's got a psychiatrist who has not interviewed him with regard to his thoughts when he committed the murder.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. That fitness report at page 68, it's 14 pages, and he does in fact discuss what his state of mind was at the time of the crime. He does in fact do that. Your Honor, Dr. Perwatiker's affidavit reproduced at page 64 of the separate appendix says, Mr. Schnock, trial counsel, asked, can you render opinion based on the information you gained at the fitness interview? And he said, I could. I told him I could, which is absolutely consistent with Dr. Perwatiker's trial testimony where he said he could do it. He could do it. And post-conviction, this was a counsel post-conviction petition, Your Honor. And on post-conviction...
There's apparently a difference of psychiatric opinion about the relevance of all these events before... and after the murder, right? These two psychiatrists disagree about whether the fact that he called 911 is relevant or it isn't.
Absolutely, that's right. Dr. Perwatiker thought that the acts after the event couldn't discern his current mental state from that. Yes. But even petitioner's own post-conviction expert, Dr. Killian, he goes out and he gets a psychological expert, second opinion. He says. It wasn't inappropriate for Dr. Perwatiker to render his sanity opinion based on that earlier January interview. And now counsel made...
The question isn't whether it's inappropriate, but whether it is minimally effective advocacy.
Your Honor,
because what he did was he armed the prosecutor for this devastating cross-examination.
Your Honor, an attorney should be allowed to. He has to be allowed
Look,
to try.
Look, what would have been involved in having him re-interview Wilson? Nothing.
But
no expense. Nothing. There's no reason why not to do that. No strategic consideration that might argue against that.
Well, as a technical matter, could he re-interview Wilson at this point and determine something about his mental state when he committed the crime?
Well, that's another point that Mr. Schnock, trial counsel, brought out. He said, Look, here's the reason why you should credit Dr. Parwatikar's testimony, because he is the one who interviewed petitioner in January of 2004 when his mental state most closely approximated that at the time of the crime. You have to remember that petitioner had untreated mental illness, depending on whose diagnosis you believe, but he certainly was delusional. And so when Dr. Parwatikar interviewed him in January of 2004, he was still suffering from that. It was untreated mental illness. Now, by the time the state's expert, Dr. Henry, interviews him almost a year later, he's been treated with a course of psychotropic medications, and his mental state is much different. So trial counsel pointed that out, as well as the fact that Dr. Parwatikar, of course, he pointed out his 30-year history. He pointed out his 10-page CV. Also the point that Dr. Parwatikar's opinion was good enough for the state when the issue was fitness, and that's another reason why you should credit him here, because now they're saying all of a sudden his opinion isn't good enough and should be credited.
So look what the prosecutor said in his closing argument about Parwatikar. Imagine somebody coming into the hospital unconscious, blue, and the medical staff looks at him, the doctor looks at him, person is unconscious, turned blue. All right, I've seen enough, examined him, he's not in any cardiac distress, leaves the room. Pretty soon the medical staff revives him or awakens him. Nurse comes in, asks the doctor, hey, he's awakened. Do you want to examine him? Do you want to talk to him? Nah, he's awake. Does that sound like good medical practice? Does that sound like a thorough approach?
Counsel asked the expert. He consulted a psychiatric expert. Of course, lawyers are not psychiatric experts. I certainly don't pretend to be one. But he asked his expert whether he could render an opinion based on his fitness examination, based on the information he had gathered during the fitness examination. And the expert advised counsel that he could, and it was not unreasonable for him to rely on his expert's representation to that effect. If there are no further questions, we'd ask that this court affirm the district.
The other thing I find very disturbing is this business of light switch insanity.
Well, that's the pejorative characterization of it.
Is that appropriate in a case like this? And also, what is the basis for thinking that which Parwatikar seemed to have agreed to? I mean, he was hopeless. And he testified, that the cross-examination of him was devastating, and it was devastating. And he said, yes, when Wilson called 9/11 after killing Fisher, he was sane. I mean, that's ridiculous. Most of what insane people do is perfectly sane, right? Insane people do not ordinarily cross the street in front of a car and get run down, right? So you wouldn't say about a lunatic, well, sometimes he's a lunatic, but when he crosses the street, he waits for the light, so he's sane, and then later he's insane. No, it doesn't work that way. Insane people, like this guy, they're often hyper-logical. They just have a crazy premise, but they reason from the premise. So he's got it all worked out. The Catholics are against him. Fisher's part of the plot. It's all logical. But it's crazy, right? So you can be logical and you can be crazy. You can call 9/11. You can be sorry for what you did. And you can still be insane. And this light switch business, of course, obscures that.
That seems to go to really his contention or his complaint that counsel didn't seek a second expert opinion. He's not required to shop for a second expert. And what's key here, Your Honor, is we don't know whether trial counsel even looked for a second opinion. Because, for instance, then post-conviction, there wasn't an affidavit from the trial attorney saying, I looked or
saying
I didn't
look. Saying he
needed
a second opinion. He's got this psychiatrist. The psychiatrist...
But you're suggesting his opinion was inadequate.
Well, he could at least have had the psychiatrist re-interview Wilson so he could assure the court that he had done a careful examination. He wasn't just extrapolating from his fitness exam to an opinion about sanity at the time of the crime. It would have been so simple. There wasn't any downside. I don't understand why he didn't do it. Anyway,
Thank you. We'd ask that you affirm the district court's judgment tonight.
So, Mr. Friesen, I think his time expired. You can have a minute if you want.
Your Honor, I briefly wanted to answer one of the court's questions directed to the opposing counsel, asking about planning and the relevance that that might or might not have to sanity. And Illinois state courts have repeatedly referred to plans that indicated somebody was appreciative of the criminality of their conduct when those plans included means to escape detection or ways to dispose of evidence, or things along those lines, because then it indicates that somebody, when they are acting, is aware of the fact that they're appreciative of the reality of their conduct.
I want to go back to what I asked counsel about these various verdict options that you have in a case like this. One option is guilty as charged, first-degree intentional homicide.
Yes.
The jury acquits on that charge, in effect, because the jury believes he is guilty but has a mental illness. Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the counsel is effective. He's had a counsel that has given him effective assistance insofar as they got the jury to give him a pass on the most serious charge.
Well, Your Honor,
and on the second charge.
I would point out that the state, the prosecutor at trial, in his closing argument, specifically told the jury that the prosecution was taking guilty, just plain guilty, off the table and was only seeking guilty but mentally ill.
But I thought the answer was that when I asked the counsel for the state, that the state had urged a finding of guilty, period.
That's actually contradicted by the record. If you would like, I can refer to this, but in counsel's...
We can find out what it was, but I thought that that was the response that Ms. Sanders gave to one of the questions that was asked.
I can't speak to what her response was. I think the purpose of introducing a guilty but mentally ill verdict legislatively was to prevent jurors from being concerned about treatment.
Sure.
And thereby,
I mean, everybody
acquitting.
Looks at this case and would look at this guy and say, well, this guy's got something, a screw loose here. So the jury doesn't want to give him a complete pass by finding him not guilty by reason of insanity. So that this legislative response, which counsel says 16 states have now adopted, is kind of a way to compromise out these kind of verdicts, isn't it?
It may be a way to compromise out the verdicts in general. In this particular instance, the issue of guilt versus guilt but mentally ill was never contested, and the prosecution described guilty and then said, but that's really off the table because Dr. Henry had also testified that he was mentally ill.
I gather from what you're saying about planning that Dr. Parwatakar did not think that was relevant. Is that right?
Dr. Parwatakar's opinion, this referring to his sanity, the report on insanity, was that the rationality was the key, that he was building his actions around this delusional reality and not around reality. And so whether or not he was planning in conjunction with that delusional belief wouldn't necessarily indicate that he was sane or insane either way.
Well, I thought that he thought that only the state of affairs at the time of the crime was relevant and not matters before or after. Is that correct?
I think he understood that the standard was the mental state at the time of the shooting. He did look at other events, and he took those into consideration, those that he had information from, from doing his fitness evaluation and considered the consistency of other events with the rationality that was perceived and demonstrated in sort of this extensive history of delusions. There are no further questions, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Friesen. You were appointed.
Yes, sir.
Not. We thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client, and we thank Ms. Sanders as well.